So this is the third in the series that we have initiated on Earth Sila. And as you no doubt know by now, Sila is the collective term for three of the eight aspects of the Eightfold Path, the Buddha's teachings on the cessation of suffering, or at least that form of suffering that the mind manages to generate all by itself. Okay, he talked about different forms of suffering, those associated with being in a physical body, those associated with being a social being, and then those associated with the mind's ceaseless effort to construct some sense of self. Never fully succeeding, but always trying. And his teachings on how to bring that form of suffering to an end have to do with, of course, gaining a much deeper understanding of who we truly are on a moment-to-moment basis, which is that basically we are just that. And so the various means that he taught for achieving the cessation of the distress that's caused by this form of mental activity involves first doing what we first got here this evening, which is meditation practice, the meditative factors of concentration and effort and mindfulness, establishing mindfulness of everything that the mind is up to, and then some inquiry, the wisdom factors, the two wisdom factors of gaining insight ultimately into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are at any given point in time. Okay, the co-arising of all phenomena, including ourselves. Also insight into some of the ways that we do, in fact, cause ourselves distress. And then also gaining insight into, or a little bit of an opportunity, a skill, a capability of looking very briefly into the future. Seeing, okay, if I act on this particular set of intentions, I can see that the outcome is likely to be this. If I speak these words in this way, based on my past experience and my insights into my nature, the outcome is likely to be thus and so. Okay. In terms of how I live my life, again, being able to recognize this cause and effect relationship between how we behave and what the outcomes are. So, Sila, having to do with speech, with individual actions, and with way of life, are for the most part the Buddha's advice on how to live together peacefully in community, on how to apply his teachings about the cessation of suffering to living together. Okay. In terms of how we speak to each other, how we listen to each other. In terms of specific actions, what I've done for the purposes of this series is to drop into that category these five precepts for laypersons that the Buddha suggested, which is to abstain from killing living beings, okay? To not take stuff that doesn't belong to you and that you know belongs to somebody else, not taking that which is not given, not engaging in sexual misconduct, not lying, either to yourself or to another. And doing what you can to maintain a clear mind, which is to say not ingesting intoxicants that make it impossible for you to be mindful and make it more likely that you're going to say or do something that's unskillful. So taking those as a starting point, what I've been doing then in this series is take, okay, well, these are precepts that mostly apply to how we relate to each other, humans and community. And what I'm doing is adapting that, those kind of core classic teachings, to what it means to live in the community of all sentient beings. In terms of our relationship, not just to other human beings, but to all creation. So we're definitely talking about what Bhikkhu Bodhi would call adaptive Buddhism as far as this series is concerned. A couple of weeks ago, I was giving an introductory talk on the Earth Sila program or project that I've undertaken here, and it was at David Chernikov's Sangha in Boulder. And one of the people who was there was a fellow named David Lloyd. He's one of the editors of this book, The Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. It was published in 2009. And it's a collection of essays by various well-known Buddhist teachers on bringing Buddha Dharma to bear on the climate crisis. Okay. And of course, that line of inquiry fits very much within the sort of larger context that I'm talking about here, which is just how do we get right in terms of our relationships with all of the sentient beings. And David's question after the talk, he's going to be here, I think he's going to be with this sangha maybe sometime around mid-September. It's definitely worth coming to hear. Said, well, you know, it certainly is a good starting point insofar as trying to clean up our act with regard to the environment in terms of, you know, trying to buy organic food and trend toward vegetarianism and drive a fuel-efficient car and whatnot. But, you know, he pointed out that one of the kind of aspects of the precepts, the way they're traditionally taught, is that they're mostly about do what you can to avoid this behavior because of the consequences that will ensue. Okay. So, and inevitably, given our enculturation, we tend to think of them more as commandments than we do teaching guidelines. And basically, what the Buddha was giving was more like natural history lessons. So, you know, if you speak in this way, or you act in this way, or you live in this way, it's going to have these consequences. Okay. If your interest, if your goal is bringing suffering to an end, then it's really worth paying attention to the intentions that underlie how you speak and act and so forth. So he was basically just trying to focus our attention on this causal relationship between actions and consequences. But what David was saying, you know, I thought it was a point that was very well taken. You know, it sounds like when you talk about actions only in terms of these precepts, it's like kind of like tiptoeing around trying to avoid doing harm, you know, not much else. When in fact, there's a lot more to it than that, actually. If you know, the flip side of trying to avoid killing living beings is just honoring life, right? And not, you know, being kind rather than cruel, being compassionate to all sentient beings. The flip side of not taking that which is not given is generosity. Okay. So there is indeed a positive aspect to each one of these things. But insofar as what David was really talking about, which is action in the world on a concerted basis, you know, social action of one kind or another. As I said in the first two talks, you know, I'm all for that depending upon the intention underlying the action. Okay. So if we think, you know, kind of visually make our way around the Dharma wheel, you know, that's essentially what I'm advising here as well. You know, first to do what you can to awaken, to become mindful of the effects of your actions in the environment. So awakening, I think, is definitely, you know, one function. Learning what you can. You know, the Buddha actually talked a lot in his discourses, not just about meditating until your samadhi gets deep. He talked a lot about thinking and pondering. Those are the words that were used. And that's basically applying your intelligence, you know, and your rational capabilities to a look at what's going on in the mind and to a look at how you live your life. So that's very much, you know, in the vein of what he had to suggest in terms of the use of the mind. So awakening, learning. Another function is bearing witness. Okay. And that happens often in the form of silent demonstrations, right? If you are aware that there is some unskillful activity going on out there in the world, and it seems worthy of bringing public attention to it, you know, in a non-dual, non-confrontational, non-adversarial way, it's very possible just to get together and bear witness. Okay. And there are various ways to do that, various forms that can take. And some of these activities that I'm suggesting are actually borrowed from the peace movement. And, you know, one member of our sangha said, well, you know, it seems like what we're about here, what you're talking about, really does seem to be kind of an environmental peace movement. And he's right. Okay, that's very much in the same vein, of the same framing of intention that I, at least on my part, is going on here. Beyond bearing witness is giving voice. Finding opportunities, if they are presented, to share your views, to share your insights, okay, to share your own intentions on whatever the subject is with regard to compassionate treatment of all sentient beings, whatever the particular context has to be. Okay. Giving voice to your views and to your intentions and to your aspirations is a real art form, as we know. So that's why I'm saying that, you know, it's a skill that takes a lot of attention and a lot of practice and a lot of study and a lot of grounding and beneficial intention. So you don't find yourself immediately getting caught up in kind of an adversarial and negative discourse, which is very, very easy to do. So the more clearly grounded you are in your intentions and your practice and your insight, the more likely it's going to be that you'll be able to move forward in all these realms of activity in a way that doesn't simply replicate the kind of adversarial interaction that characterizes so much work around the environment these days. Another form of activity is supporting and serving. Okay. So there are myriad forms of activity going on out there already that various groups are undertaking or are thinking of undertaking, having to do with some aspect of living in harmony with other sentient beings. Okay. So it's really worth investigating and seeing what you can find out there that is more or less aligned with your views and your values that you might want to find yourself getting plugged into. One of the things that I am actually advocating when I've spoken to the other sanghas along the Front Range and would love to see happen in all of them is if we had some sort of kind of affinity group maybe grow up within each of the sanghas that can sort of reflect a little together on, number one, just kind of inventorying what else there is going on out there that might be of interest and we might want to relate to, and then if there are any activities of any form that we might want to undertake ourselves. I think these are all very worthy, rich areas of inquiry for us. And then finally, when all else fails, as happened from time to time in the peace movement, intervening, which is to say, stepping up and stepping in. If it appears that there is some fairly grievous event or activity going on that is obviously directly harming sentient beings in some way that really touches your heart and you feel called upon to do what you can to bring that to a halt, then direct nonviolent action is always another alternative, always, you know. Jack and Sylvia and others, I know, have gotten busted a couple times already for intervening as mindfully as they knew how to do in certain activities in the Bay Area recently. So to revisit what I was speaking about last week for a little while, and mostly focusing last week on the Buddhist precept about not killing living beings. And the starting point for the classical teachings, you know, when I was investigating in some of my research, you know, what exactly did that mean insofar as what the Buddha said and what some of the classical commentaries of the time had to say. What did they mean when they used the term living beings? Their criteria for what was a living being was something that was capable of experiencing and responding to vedana. Vedana is the Pali term for feeling, which is not really a very good translation, but it means the ability of an organism to distinguish pleasant from unpleasant sensations. Okay. And in the case of their definition, to respond accordingly, to be able to discern whether a sensory input is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then to respond accordingly to the information they get through that sensory input. The other criterion they had was respiration. So for them, using those two criteria, they said animals are sentient beings, but plants not so much. They were going on the scientific information that they had available to them at the time. Last week, I shared some research that's been going on at the University of Utah and several other centers that have really begun to focus on questions of intelligence in the plant world and how some species of plants plan their growth patterns 2 years in advance based on climatic data. That they've taken in, that they can communicate over vast distances through their root systems and also gases and resins that they put into the atmosphere and tell each other about oncoming fires or about oncoming droughts or warning each other of disease outbreaks. Okay, so we've got a very substantial amount of data now to show that plant life also meets the first of those criteria. And we also know that plants respire, just like we do. Okay. The gases that are exchanged are different than ours in terms of their proportions, right? If they didn't respire, we would not be here, right? If they did not exhale fresh oxygen, okay, that we depend upon in order to survive, we wouldn't be here. And then likewise, they do their best to take up as to inhale as much carbon dioxide as they can, which is what we exhale. But of course, we as a species are exhaling it in vastly greater quantities than we ever did before, which is of course turning out to be kind of a problem. So the bottom line, and here's my departure point in terms of a reinterpretation of some of these ancient criteria. Okay. So for the purposes of my own understanding, my own scholarship in this area, my own teaching, and my offering of this series, I am very much of the view that green plants are sentient beings just like animals are. Okay. And that, with the exception of plants that take inanimate matter and create, you know, organic matter out of it, life feeds on life. Something is killed in order that we might live. Okay. Whether it's plants or animals, that seems to be the nature of the system. Okay. So it then becomes not really possible to avoid killing living beings in order to live. So I then understand the Buddha's teaching of that precept of not killing living beings as being as mindful as you possibly can about what is killed, how, and for what purpose. So again, as I pointed out, even though the Buddha and his followers were omnivores because they depended on alms to survive and they were living in cultures that were not vegetarian. Okay. He also asked that no animals be killed in order for the purpose of creating a meal for the monks. If they were simply sharing what was already there, then they ate what was there. They ate what was offered. But that otherwise they seek to avoid having killing of animals done specifically for their benefit. Okay. So, this attending to then, this question of what was killed that we might live, has a real bearing as we look at how we sustain ourselves in the world. Okay. You know, whether or not we depend, whether or not or to what extent We find that for health or other reasons that we do depend on animal protein to support ourselves, if so, what form? And then inquiring more deeply into what was the life cycle of that being that you're eating. Okay. How is it raised? Under what circumstances? How is it killed? These are questions that are really worthy of inquiry. And it goes for plant life as well. Because as we know, there are a great many different circumstances under which plants are raised, both here in this country and abroad, since a lot of our food actually winds up getting imported. Okay. In some modes of agricultural production, you know, of vegetables and fruit, there's an awful lot of killing that goes on. Okay. Mostly in the form of pesticides. So that's something worth keeping in mind, both in terms of our own health, but also in terms of the production of food overall. Which is therefore to say that to the extent that you can incline yourself in, you know, in terms of market forces to eating more from the organic end of the spectrum, you know, organically raised, pesticide-free raised foods, that's a good thing. Okay. If you're casting about for some kind of social action to get involved in, however, this is one that has several different angles to it. One of the phenomena that you may have learned about, if you've been paying attention to these things, you know, anything having to do with food policy, is this phenomenon called food deserts. You know, in most of the major cities of the United States and certainly elsewhere in the world, there are very significant parts of town and neighborhoods where there aren't any grocery stores, okay, or very few. And in order for anyone living in one of those neighborhoods to adequately nourish themselves, they have to travel some distance. And oftentimes they just wind up going to the corner store where they find a lot of highly processed foods, not much at all in the way of fresh food. In this country also, there is a very high correlation between obesity and poverty. Okay. The cheapest calories, by and large, are the most unhealthy ones. So we can go on and on about, oh, well, we ought to just eat organic vegetables, right? Well, they're more expensive, for one thing. They're harder to come by. And vast segments of the population can't even afford them. So a lot of folks would like to be eating healthier than they are. And they would like to be eating vegetables that didn't require the slaying of millions of insects in order to provide them nutrition. They just don't have the opportunity. So that's an area, if you're looking around for something to plug into, that's really worth inquiring into and learning more about. There are some interesting sources of information that I have come across having to do with this question of why is something killed and for what purpose? Several years ago, about 20 years or so ago now, I wrote a book called Worship in the Wilderness. It's about the religious use of public lands and resources. It's mostly about the First Amendment freedom of exercise of religion rights of American Indian tribes and their relationship to the public lands. And while I was working on that book, and afterwards, one of the things that I did was to serve as an advisor to an organization called the Intertribal Bison Cooperative. And that was an organization of 48 American Indian tribes that were interested in reintroducing plains bison back onto their reservations and raising them both as a wholesome food source for people living on the reservation, also for the purposes of religious observance, because they have this long-standing, the plains tribes in particular, this very long-standing intimate spiritual relationship with the buffalo. And then as a means of sort of economic sustenance as well. So there was a big gathering of the leaders of all the tribes, the herd managers of all the tribes and some of their tribal officials at the law school at the University of Colorado in Boulder that I attended. And it was a ceremonial gathering is also a celebratory gathering because several of these tribes had just gotten their herds well established and they were They were feeding their reservation residents. They were starting to make money at it. They were, for the most part, raising their buffalo in accordance with, you know, traditional practices and observances. And so they organized this gathering, and there was a great deal of ritual, and I got there, I was also looking forward to the fact that there was going to be this feast that had been prepared by the herd managers with buffalo from the Wind River Reservation herd. And so we had the ceremony and these speeches and whatnot, and the program went on and on, and I was getting hungrier and hungrier and hungrier. And then finally got to an end, and we lined up, and we went through the line, and we got our food, and I sat down, and I started eating, I must admit, most unmindfully. I was just shoveling it in at quite a good clip. And then suddenly, something happened. There was this vision that kind of arose. And instead of seeing the room with the other people and it eating and talking and whatnot, I was out on the prairie in the spring morning, and there was just after dawn, and it had just rained, and there was dew on, there was water, there was, you know, the grasses were damp. And the sky was really brilliant with clouds and blue sky and sunshine. And I could smell the prairie. And I'd just literally been transported from this very kind of eerie, kind of out-of-the-body experience. And then it ended, and I was just back to eating again, but felt a little shaken, you know, what had gone on there. And so one of the herd managers that I had befriended, who was part of the executive committee for the Intertribal Bison Cooperative, was nearby, and I was just sort of sheepishly, I told him what had just happened to me. And he said, oh. He said, you didn't just eat the buffalo. You took in the buffalo. He said, now you know why we take such good care of our buffalo. It's because they become us. And this was an intimate relationship, what he was saying, you know. So their relationship with their buffalo herds is sacred, right? They kill and eat them, but not in the way that you or I might have a hamburger. It has a completely different meaning. And it's a completely different relationship. Okay. And so that for me was a very important lesson. It was an experiential lesson of right. He said, when you pay attention, when you eat, that can happen. Right? You take in the buffalo. And we die, we go back to the earth, we become the buffalo again. Okay. They become us. That it's cyclical in nature. And he said it's been going on, you know, in their way of understanding things forever. But we do know, archaeologically, it's been going on for at least 12,000 years, right? This relationship between these people and the buffalo. Okay. So that kind of symbiotic relationship exists. It's out there. It's part of a lot of cultures. And so it has a lot of bearing on why they treat the environment in the way that they do. Because they see and understand and experience the interrelationship. That how we treat the things that we eat affects who we are and how we are as a result. So for them, killing is a sacred thing. And the herd manager that shot the buffalo that we ate actually talked about going out into the field. And I've heard this from several other hunters. In the Taos Pueblo, when I went to a deer dance there, they said the same thing. They said when they go for a hunt, they might follow several different animals, but he said at some point they know that there is one that they were meant to take, and they'll follow it into the field. And if they've chosen well, then rather than running away at every opportunity, they said at some point the animal turns side two and offers itself as a target so that it will be killed more easily and less painfully. And I've heard that story from enough people that, you know, in the various tribes that do ritual hunting, that I came to believe that it's actually true. So it's possible to have this kind of relationship between what sustains us and what we in turn take some responsibility for sustaining. The lessons come from interesting places on these questions of life and death. One of them is a Supreme Court decision from 1993 that I haven't really been looking a whole lot just lately for moral guidance from the United States Supreme Court, I must say, but every once in a while they do come out with a pretty interesting decision, and this was one of them. Church of Lukumi Babalu versus Town of Hialeah, Florida, in 1993. In the 18th century, there was an African tribe, the Yoruba people of Western Africa, who were captured and enslaved and brought to the West Indies and to Cuba to work as plantation slaves. And the Yoruba people have continued to live in Cuba, and as is the case with other indigenous peoples that got Christianized, what happened was there was a kind of a combining of some of their practices from their animistic religion with traits of Catholicism. And with regard to the descendants of the Yoruba in Cuba, it took the form of a religion called Santeria. And in the late 1970s, when Castro decided to get rid of a lot of his undesirables and let them flee the country to the U.S., the Santerians were among the groups that wound up in the southeastern United States, in Florida. And some of them moved to the town of Hialeah, Florida, and set up a little community and set up a church. And one aspect of the practice of Santeria is the ritual sacrifice of animals. Okay. They usually eat them afterwards. Not always, but usually. Okay. And when this became known, the town council in Hialeah passed an emergency ordinance that forbade the unnecessary killing of animals. He said the unnecessary and inhumane killing of animals in the town of Hialeah shall be prohibited. Okay. And they immediately applied it to the Santerians and said, you may not establish your church here because you as part of your religion, you engage in this now illegal practice. And so eventually they lawyered up and they all ran out to court, or we wouldn't be reading this case. And it got up to the court, and there was this majority opinion by Justice Kennedy in which they went through the rationale for the city of Hialeah's ordinance, and they looked at the actual practice of the Santerians. And he said, okay, well, so no unnecessary killing, right? No inhumane killing. What are some of the forms of killing that you allow in your city? Well, we have sports fishing, right? In which a steel hook goes into the mouth of a fish, it's yanked out of the water, and suffocates, right? How about hunting? Yeah, sports hunting, you do that too, right? The case law on the up to that point in time on the state law prohibiting inhumane killing of an unnecessary killing of animals was one in which there had been a challenge to the people who train greyhound dogs to race in dog tracks The way they train them was by putting them in a high-walled track with a live rabbit. And the dogs would chase the rabbit around until they killed it and tore it apart. Okay, caught it and tore it apart. And said, oh, well, it looks like the courts have decided that that's necessary killing because it's incidental to a very lucrative business, just dog racing in Florida. Okay. You've decided that sports fishing is necessary because, again, it's financially lucrative and people like to do it. Okay. What really is necessary and what is unnecessary killing? Okay. How do the Santerians kill the chickens and the goats and whatnot that they use? Well, they calm them, and then they very quickly slit both of their carotid arteries. Okay. Let's see. Who else does that in a ritual way? Ah! That's the very way kosher butchers kill their livestock. Right? So the animal dies quickly and not in fear. So they said, the court did, it looks to us like you kind of single these people out because you don't care much for their religion. If you got serious about not wanting unnecessary killing and not wanting inhumane killing in your community, okay, there are probably lots of different kinds of killing that you would not be allowing. Okay, but such is not the case. Okay. The Sangha member was telling me last time I was here that... one of the, I guess who was it, Bernard Shaw, when he was asked why he was a vegetarian, says because carrots don't scream as loud as cattle when they're killed. So paying attention, what's the purpose, what's the means, okay, to what end? Life feeds on life. There was a newspaper reporter, also a poet, many years ago. His name was Don Marquis. And in addition to being he wrote a frequent column, and it was about anything that crossed his mind, actually. But he wrote mostly through the character of two animals. And he said that he had come to work one morning and had found a cockroach on his keyboard, on his typewriter. And what the cockroach did every night was come in and he would butt his head against the keys to type out messages to him. Okay. His name was Archie the cockroach. And so Archie wrote him stories at night that he would, of course, recount in his column about what was going on with he and his other animal friends. His best friend was an alley cat named Mehitabel. And so his column pieces were eventually collected into a series called The Lives and Times of Archie and Mehitabel. And one of the... little treatises, one of the essays that turned up in this column was one that's titled The Robin and the Worm. A robin said to an angleworm as he ate him, "I'm sorry, but a bird has to live somehow." The worm, being slow-witted, could not gather his dissent into a wisecrack and retort. He was effectually swallowed before he could turn a phrase. By the time he had reflected long enough to say, but why must a bird live? He felt the beginnings of a gradual change invading him. Some new and disintegrating influence was stealing along him from his positive to his negative pole. And he did not have the mental stamina of a Jonah to resist the insidious process of assimilation, which comes like a thief in the night. "Demons and fish hooks," he exclaimed. "I am losing my personal identity as a worm. My individuality is melting away from me. Odds craw, I am becoming part and parcel of this bloody robin." So help me, I am thinking like a robin, not like a worm anymore. Yes, yes, I even find myself agreeing that a robin must live. I still do not understand with my mentality why a robin must live. Yet I swoon into a condition of belief. Yes, yes, by heck, that is my dogma, and I shout it, a robin must live. Amen, said a beetle who had preceded him into the interior. That is the way I feel myself. Is it not wonderful when one arrives at the place where he can give up his ambitions and resignedly, nay, even with gladness, recognize that it is a far, far better thing to be merged harmoniously in the cosmic all, and this comfortable situation in his midst so affected the marauding robin that he perched upon a blooming twig and sang until the blossoms shook with ecstasy. He sang, I have a good digestion, and there is a God after all, which I was wicked enough to doubt yesterday when it rained. Breakfast, breakfast, I am full of breakfast, and they are at breakfast in heaven. They breakfast in heaven, all is well with the world. So intent was this pious and murderous robin on his own sweet song that he did not notice Mehitabel the cat sneaking toward him. She pounced just as he had extended his larynx in a melodious burst of thanksgiving, and he went the way of all flesh, fish, and good red herring. Aha, purred Mehitabel, licking the last feather from her whiskers. Was that not a beautiful song he was singing just before I took him to my bosom? They breakfast in heaven, all is well with the world. How true it is! And even yet his song echoes in the haunted woodland of my midriff. Peace and joy in the world and over all the provident skies. How beautiful is the universe when something digestible meets with an eager digestion. How sweet the embrace when Adam rushes to the arms of waiting Adam. And they dance together, skimming with fairy feet along a tide of gastric juices. Oh, feline cosmos, you were made for cats. I have a gusto this morning, I have a hunger, I have a yearning to hear from my stomach further music in accord with the mystic chanting of the spheres of the stars that sang together in the dawn of creation, prophesying food for me. I have a faith that Providence has hidden for me in yonder tall grass, still more ornithological delicatessen. Oh, gaily let me strangle what is gaily given. Well, well, boss, writes Archie. There is something to be said for the lyrical and imperial attitude. Believe that everything is for you until you discover that you are for it. Sing your faith in what you eat right up to the minute you are eaten. For consumed you will surely be. The great circle of life, right? What goes around comes around. So, moving over into this precept about not taking that which is not given. There is a real relationship, does it not, to what we were just talking about before. For me, not taking what is not given invites the question, insofar as our existence is concerned, what is given? What's given to us? Makes it possible for us to be here.
Water.
Thank you. Absolutely. If it were not available to us, we would not be here. We would not exist. What else? Air. Okay. Essentials of life, right? The converse side of that, if you're looking around for something to start paying attention to and maybe get engaged in, water and air are taken on a regular and continuing basis. When water is polluted to the point where it cannot be used to sustain life, it is taken. When air is polluted to the point that it cannot sustain life and may even tend to discourage or end life, that is taken. It was not given, but it was taken. So in speaking about the precepts, they don't apply to just us. And the Buddha said, okay, if you do this, things will turn out one way. If you do that, it'll turn out the other way. They apply to us all. And they apply to our civilization and to our society and to how the human species inhabits the planet. Okay. So this precept of not taking that which is not given is important. Okay. It's real. And it's worth attending to. You know, if there are instances where you feel that that is being done, and it's something that feels like it needs to be observed and it needs to be given voice to. Okay. It's another area that's very worthy of inquiry and very possibly worthy of some possible action. So I think it's also possible to reasonably assume, in terms of what is given, what do sentient beings need to survive? So, air, water, nutriment, okay, in our case, shelter, right? So, it seems reasonable to assume that we being here have these needs, and therefore trying to meet those needs as mindfully as we can, okay, is not really taking that which is not given, because that's what's needed in order for us to survive. Where it starts to get interesting, of course, is when we start looking at the distinction between needs and wants. Okay. Or like the Dalai Lama said, you know, we seek pleasure as a substitute for happiness. Okay. The things that we consume, the things we bring to us, you know. In many cases, we don't do because we need them necessarily, but because they fulfill some other purpose instead. We were recently cleaning out the... You know, we had somebody coming to visit, and we figured it was a good time to clean out our chest of drawers of, you know, our clothing, and which had accumulated over the years. And there's this one chest of drawers where I keep all my winter clothing. So I started going through the chest of drawers, and I found 22 pair of heavy-duty winter socks. And the way I came by those socks was that we moved here from the San Francisco Bay Area, and before that I lived in Arizona, right? So this is by far the coldest environment I'd ever lived in. And from the day we got here, from the first winter I experienced here, I was convinced that the weather was trying to kill me and that I needed to do everything possible to protect myself from it, okay? So every winter I would go out, you know, and I had gone on a cross-country ski trip once not long after we got here. We were out considerably after sunset, involuntarily, and my feet kind of got numb. And so then every winter, I would go stock up on winter socks, you know, and friends like Sharon Salzberg and Wendy Zarin would come to visit, and I'd rant and rave about winters, and they'd say, well, you know, you seem to take the weather very personally, you know. And when I looked back on it, these piles and piles of winter boot socks, now most of which I'll be giving away, I can say I basically bought them out of fear. Right? Didn't have anything to do with real need. It had to do with fear of the weather. You know? And it was kind of revelatory. Another example of why we buy some of the things we do. And to me, that felt like a desperate need. You know, that was like survival level purchasing that I was doing every year. And then I found out that my closet space had no more space for all the jackets I'd bought. You know, same thing. So one of the reasons. Another thing that, crossed my mind in terms of one of the reasons we buy the things that we do. I had been in, several times a year we go to visit friends in the San Francisco Bay Area, Berkeley, where we used to live. And just south of campus there is a used clothing store, a vintage clothing store. And in the vintage clothing store is they always had this rack of Hawaiian shirts for $10. And there are a lot of them are pretty good shirts. And so every time I'm in town, I always go in there and I start going through the shirts. And I usually find one or two that I kind of like and bring home. Got quite a few now. And I'd gone through this rack once and passed over several of them. And then there was somebody else who was going through the shirts as well. And he came across a couple and he said, "Wow, that's a good shirt, you know. Tommy Bahama, 100% silk, they're all $10. Says too big for me, but it would fit you. Have a look." And it was one that I'd already kind of looked and passed over. Okay. But I looked at it again, and the fact that he liked it was enough that made me decide that I had to get it. So the reasons we bring things to us, you know, are worthy of inquiry. It's not trying to guilt trip anybody. You know, we have we buy presents for others that aren't necessarily things they need, but we think it'll please them. There's no reason why we shouldn't do the same for ourselves. But it offers an opportunity to pause and to reflect on what we really need versus what we just kind of want. Right. So any thoughts or reflections that anyone has on any of this? Please, Georgia.
Gloria.
I'm Nick Gloria.
You know, I was just sitting here wondering about the logical implications of it all. I flashed on the Gaia hypothesis, the notion that the Earth is an organism, as some believe, with rights of its own, with intrinsic value.
Yes.
And I recently reread an article by a thinker named Edmund O. Wilson.
Yes.
It was a beautiful essay. Talking about the relative importance of insects, essentially invertebrates, versus humans, and the fact that if we disappeared tomorrow, the planet would be much better, thank you very much, whereas there are a number of insects, bees for example, if they disappeared, the planet would eventually and quickly die. I mean, you know, sort of, I guess depending on your ethical scheme, and I was wondering, what Buddhism, it seems like we have an obligation to just, you know, kiss off.
Dig a hole, get in, beat yourself to death with a club.
Right? Well, for the planet Mars, we're talking about that. Yeah. I'd be doing the planet a favor if we do.
Well, you know, it's been hypothesized that with regard to the rapidity and the severity of climate change, that we may be in the process of doing just that. We may indeed be in the process of gradually making the planet uninhabitable for human beings. Insofar as loss of food supplies, rising of disease rates, we rather hope that isn't the case, and of course one of the reasons that I undertook this series is to see if we could do what we can to keep from meeting that end. But it's been hypothesized with actually a fair amount of data to support it that may be indeed what's going on. That we just, it was a great experiment, but if we don't get a whole lot smarter or a whole lot faster, it may not have a whole lot longer to run.
Oh, along that line is an interesting book that called The World Without Us, and it documents what actually will happen. It's quite well researched what will happen when humans, you know, kiss off, and how the world will, what will happen gradually over millennia.
Okay, please.
So before we all kiss off in a mass extinction, Part of what I was thinking as you were talking is the need to be more mindful in what we do with our bodies when we're gone. If life nourishes life, that's one of the things that I've thought about different times that humans have been in this process of embalming and encasing, and we're not nourishing, we're not keeping ourselves in that cycle. We're not nourishing that which feeds us even. So,
yep.
Yeah, just another thought.
Yes, yes, please.
Well, I will guess that. Yeah, I've told my wife, and I can't get anybody to take me seriously, that I'm a gardener, you know, and that I want to be composted when I'm gone. Somehow, put me under a beautiful tree or a bush or something and let me nourish it. So maybe we can find a way to do that.
Yes, we'll work on it.
Well, actually, if you own any land, you know, outside the city limits, you can get planted there, right?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe we should all chip in together, right? Yeah. I think there are rules about that when you got more than a certain number of bodies in a certain place. But on your own property, you can actually do that if you're not in some jurisdiction that forbids it.
Good landscape beforehand.
Yeah. Please.
There are cemeteries that have green burial places, mm-hmm. and buried my mother. Sewed her into a sheet and mowed her. And I wasn't here, it was somewhere else, but a friend was just telling me that she was missing. She was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's somewhere I could get in Denver where it's the least temple, least, you know, purest way to go into the ground.
Yeah.
Or you can be buried in a natural way, or you'll just decompose in this pastoral setting.
I wasn't necessarily intending that the evening come to an end. What I was rather hoping instead.
Well, someone that's the group message was.
Exactly. Distributed intelligence, they call it. I was actually rather more hoping that over time we can focus our attention on what we might possibly do between now and then. With the understanding, of course, that any efforts that we expend now, the fruits of them will probably not be realized until long after we are gone. You know, if you go around any of the cathedrals in Europe and you see these things that took 200-300 years to build, then the people who designed them and started on them, you know, knew they weren't going to be around to see them. And I think very much the same thing is true here. Given the trend lines of so much that's going on in the environment right now and the kind of effort and the fairly dramatic changes that are going to be necessary to turn things around, it's not at all likely that it's going to happen in our lifetime or maybe even our children's. So I think it's beneficial if we can sort of think in the longer term, you know, as we become part and parcel of this bloody robin. We've run out of time, as I'll have to save the music for next week. I would like for us, just for a moment, please, though, if we can, to settle in once more into our sitting posture. May we all live with ease and in safety, free from all inner and outer harm, free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May our loved ones, our friends, our family, all those whom we hold dear, likewise be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. Live with ease and know ease of well-being. All beings who walk the earth and live within it, all beings who fly in the skies above and swim in the waters below, may all beings be happy, may all beings be peaceful, and may all beings be free. All beings now alive, all beings yet to be born, all beings both seen and unseen, all beings in all the realms of existence, May all beings live with ease. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at peace. May all beings be free.